Hello and welcome to our third episode of the What the Flick podcast, which is brought to you on Thursday when apparently the gardeners are here. That noise you hear is landscaping. I'm Christy Lemire, and today I actually have two other people with me at my dining room table. I have Matt Achety.
Hello.
And I have Alonzo Duraldi.
Hi there.
And Alonzo brought his own mic and his own headphones because he is a professional, damn it. This is not his first rodeo.
This is such a potluck stone soup situation at this point.
Anyway, we are back at my dining room table. Hopefully it is a little bit less echoey. We have put a giant, fluffy Boston Red Sox blanket down on the glass coffee table, or the glass dining room table, rather. So hopefully you can hear us better from wherever you're listening to us, at home, in your car, doing laundry, wherever.
And to answer questions that people had on Twitter about, hey, when are you guys going to be on platforms for podcasts?
We're working on it.
We'd like to be.
And as to whether or not we'll ever be on video again, we're working on that too.
We are. We want to see you as much as you want to see us. And so to answer other questions you have, Matt is wearing one of his Hawaiian shirts. It's green and floral.
Yeah, big news. I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt.
But it's a subdued one for you.
Yeah.
It's kind of a pale, like an olive.
But Hawaiian shoes.
There we go.
He has Converse low tops with Hawaiian pattern.
Nice.
And we're drinking out of super boring water glasses. Yes. Sorry to disappoint you guys.
And I'm wearing...
No, you're drinking out of a garbage can.
With a straw, like a lady.
And I'm wearing my Studio Gojira t-shirt. It looks like Studio Ghibli, but it's Godzilla.
There you go. So we are always movie-themed here at all times. We've got a lot to talk about today. There are, and I'm not even exaggerating, like 38 movies opening in Los Angeles this weekend.
I've heard 40.
Is it
38? Yeah, it's insane.
I'm doing KPCC Film Week tomorrow, and I was able to get to 12 of all of these movies. Man. We're going to get to 5 today.
Well, Dave and I are doing KCRW Press Play tomorrow, but luckily the segment is so short that we can't do more than 4 movies on any given week anyway.
Right.
I've seen nothing.
Right.
Gleefully.
But Matt came to hang out with us anyway. So
because I missed you guys.
We missed you too.
I know. You're our designated Ben this week.
Yeah, I was in Kansas City last week, and then I probably could have made it to the Predator screening, but decided not to.
Right. Let's talk. Well, let's start with Predator then, because
yeah.
Predator is probably the biggie of the week in a lot of ways. We should talk about Predator.
I'm not going to see that movie.
Right. So this is the Predator. Does that mean that it's
starring
not,
a Predator?
Right. Does that mean that it's not a sequel? Is it a reboot? Is it a remake? What would you call it, Alonzo?
I mean, it assumes that the earlier films did exist and that we know about them. So I guess it's a sequel that's sort of a reboot, just because, I mean, I think something becomes a reboot automatically when there hasn't been one for a while. But I mean, Predators was how long ago?
When was Alien versus Predator?
Well, that was before that even.
Okay.
Here's my shameful confession. I have never seen a Predator movie before this one.
So, wow. So when Trevante Rhodes says, get to the chopper, you don't know why that matters?
Apparently I did not until this moment.
It's a famous line that Schwarzenegger says in the original, but he says, get to the chopper. Yes, exactly.
He yells it. The first one's solid.
Yes.
The first one's is a good John McTiernan action movie. The second one, the sequel, is not bad. You know, Predator goes to L.A. during a heat wave. The whole thing about it is that they need it hot.
Mm.
Predators from a couple years back was all right. That was a solid action movie. The Alien versus Predator movies are not good.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, they're not. They're not.
Describe this one if you can.
So this one, we have Boyd Holbrook plays a soldier who is doing some sort of snipery mission against some bad drug people in Mexico. And a UFO crashes, and there's a predator inside. And he grabs some of the predator tech and mails it to himself in case the government tries to cover it up later, which, of course, they do. And that tech winds up in the hands of his Asperger's savant genius son, played by
Jacob Tremblay
from Room. Meanwhile, the government is trying to pin the deaths of other soldiers that the alien caused onto Boyd Holbrook, so they try and put him in an insane asylum or into a psychiatric facility with other soldiers who he all meets on the bus, and they are played by Trevante Rhodes and Keegan-Michael Key and Thomas Jane and some other folks, and then they all break out because only they can defeat the Predator with the help of scientist Olivia Munn, and things blow up.
So many things blow up. This movie is so noisy and just relentlessly, repetitively so.
Yeah.
You know, and then in the middle of it.
It's also very jokey.
Well, it's a Shane Black movie.
Yeah,
right?
But I mean, even by Shane Black standards, it's real jokey.
It is, and in retrospect, and I know Matt is going to want to talk about this, it's pretty much his entire raison d'etre today here, is talking about Predator. But there are a lot of scenes in which Olivia Munn is the only woman, and they've established early on that she is brilliant and extremely capable, and so she's not necessarily a damsel who needs rescuing.
No.
But there are a lot of scenes where it's like a hotel room with her and six guys, and there are, you know, some lewd jokes about her, which in retrospect, given what we now know about
sure.
the production and her understandable complaints about the production, it seems really skeevy in retrospect.
Indeed. Actually, the movie does have a second female character. Yvonne Strahovski from Handmaid's Tale plays the ex-wife of Boyd Holbrook and the mother of the kid. And the movie almost aggressively makes sure that the two women are never in the same scene together, which is like, no, we might accidentally pass the Bechdel test. We
right.
can't have that happen.
Well, also, I mean, Yvonne Strahovski doesn't even get to leave the house. I thought she doesn't get to leave the living room and the kitchen of the house. I mean, she's like in one room.
We see her come home at some point, but yeah, she doesn't really like exist outside of the house. But yeah, obviously this movie is now tainted by what we know about the behind the scenes of it, and it's hard not, especially when it's a movie called The Predator.
Yeah.
It's hard not to think about that stuff. I saw it before all of that broke, so I mean, I can say that at the time I just thought, well, this is weirdly jokey and stakes free for a movie that's supposed to be an exciting adventure action sci-fi movie, but now on top of it has an extra layer of ew.
Yeah, so Matt, can you as succinctly as possible explain to us what happened?
All right, so
Matt just cracked his knuckles.
Yeah, oh, I'm so pissed about this. So news came to light. Olivia Munn was complaining that it turns out Steven Wilder Striegel, who had one scene in this movie with her, had about 10 years ago been convicted of trying to lure a 14-year-old cousin into a sexual relationship. Or maybe it was like 15 years ago. It was a while back. And in the meantime, he'd been a buddy of Shane Black's. They'd been living together. And Shane Black cast him in this movie and his last two movies without telling anyone that Striegel was a registered sex offender who'd been convicted of trying to lure this 14-year-old. So Olivia Munn raised a stink about it, and correctly, I think. I think that she absolutely gets to be pissed, and Fox cut the scene out of the movie, which, you know, and then Shane Black apologized for it, and she says it wasn't...
Finally. It took
him a while. And she says, you know, Munn says, it, you know, he didn't apologize to her personally. It wasn't really enough of an apology. She feels kind of abandoned by the rest of the cast and during the Toronto press. She feels like a pariah in this, which, you know, there's an interesting piece that The Wrap did today about what's happened to some of the women that have come out in other parts of the Me Too movement. And so this has tainted the movie, and it's part of the reason why I haven't seen it, because my take on this is Shane Black, look, like, he's been living with that guy for years. Like, this dude, Striegel, is basically Shane Black's Cato Kalin, like his buddy that's been living with him. Shane Black knew that there was a conviction and either didn't bother to look into it or looked into it and didn't think it was that big a deal. Neither one's a really good look, considering how much Shane Black has been putting kids in the movies he's directed for the last three movies, including this one. And so where I have an issue, because I went and looked this up, is it's bad enough that he puts Striegel in scenes with Olivia Munn without telling, you know, this guy's a registered sex offender, right? That's one thing. But my immediate thought was, well, if this is Shane Black's buddy, he's obviously showing up to premieres, right? That's just the way it goes. And post-production events, like any promo event that's some fancy, cool event, this guy gets to go because he's Black's buddy, right? So sure enough, I look up and see pictures of Striegel and Angourie Rice, the young woman who was in
Nice
The Nice
Guys.
Guys at the Nice Guys premiere.
Right, she was Ryan Gosling's daughter in The Nice
right.
Guys.
Right, and which also recontextualizes the way Shane Black writes that Angourie Rice is at the porn star party.
Yeah, watching a porno movie.
Right,
yeah.
It recontextualizes that. It's like, oh, okay, so maybe Shane Black doesn't take kind of early sexual exposure at a certain age all that seriously.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's kind of ruined the nice guys for me, and it's, you know, like, he's, my take on it is, Shane Black's apologizing because he got caught, because he got called out.
Yeah, and clearly the silence from the other dude seems to be about, like, well, look, Olivia Munn is never going to hire me in the future, but Shane Black might.
Right.
So better to just, like, ride this one out and not put my neck out because, you know, I don't want to be troubled the way she is.
Yeah, and Olivia Munn was on Ellen DeGeneres yesterday, a couple days ago, talking about this as well. And, yeah, it does seem like a lot of folks kind of left her twisting in the wind and, you know, maybe after the fact, under duress, came and supported her, which they should have on the early end. Matt, I totally appreciate you not wanting to see this movie. I kind of feel like I have to. It's our job. We kind of have to. So, I mean, between this and film week, I feel like, and also just posterity's sake, I kind of feel like we have to.
Right. I have the luxury of not having to see it.
Sure.
Right? I have that luxury. I get it. And look, like, if people want to go see it, that's fine. I'm just explaining why I'm not seeing it. And I'm going to take, you know, I will have a jaundiced view of looking at Shane Black's work in the future. And I've always really enjoyed his work.
No, me too. I mean, because for the Christmas angle alone and nothing else, you know, that's always, I've been a big fan. Like, I loved Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Me too.
You know, I like a lot of his stuff. But yeah, now it's sort of like, it's sort of like when you find out all the stuff about that Uma Thurman had to say about the shooting of of Kill Bill. And then you watch Death Proof and it's like,
we know too much. But I mean, aside from all that, it's just not a good movie. I mean, it's relentlessly one note in terms of its noise, in terms of its violence. I guess the predator creatures themselves are kind of cool looking. You know, there are various sizes and shapes of predator.
It ends with a, like, here comes the sequel thing that is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And Bibbs reviewed it for me at The Wrap, and he's a fan of the series. And he said, the ending of this movie would have been embarrassing in fan fiction. And now it's canon.
Well, you know what? I just saw this, like, 2 nights ago, and I can't remember what you're talking about, so it must not have been that impactful.
It took me a second to remember, and then I was like, oh yeah, that was stupid.
Yeah, so it's a waste of some people that do interesting work. Trevante Rhodes and Keegan-Michael Key and Thomas Jane, and they're all kind of stuck in these one-note roles in whatever their various maladies are.
That's the other thing. This movie has a very weird attitude about sort of mental issues. So it's like, okay, so the kid with Asperger's is suddenly this super genius who can translate alien languages in seconds, and then all the people in the sort of squad of mentally ill people that Boyd Holbrook gets stuck in, all they need to fix themselves was to get back into battle.
Yeah, they load up. They get locked and loaded. And
fighting predators somehow is good for what ails them.
Yeah, so I'm saying 3.2.
I said 4.5 just because, again, I saw this before all the stuff went down. And, you know, as jokey as it was, there were jokes that were good. So, you know, I didn't have a stake in the series. So I was like, I was not entertained.
Mm-hmm. So our number 3.9 is our number on Predator. I'm sorry, the Predator. It has an article before it. It's at 41% on the tomato meter. So feel free to avoid The Predator for a multitude of reasons.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, Matt. Yeah. So a movie I really liked, though, which is out this week, is A Simple Favor.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good time at that. We were laughing at that.
Yes.
So I will describe A Simple Favor for you. So this is Paul Feig's noir thriller.
Kind of.
Which does not necessarily seem like the kind of thing that Paul Feig would do, but he's taken a crack at various genres. You know, spy is his comic take on the action spy thriller.
Right.
This is his take on kind of a twisty noir. And it's still very, very funny. And it is, as you would imagine, from a film from Paul Feig, it is impeccably stylish.
Mm-hmm.
From the very first seconds of the titles.
We should point out that the gardeners are here.
Yes.
Gardeners are back, yes.
Because your yard is impeccably stylish.
That's not me. That's not our yard. That's across the street or something.
Your neighbor's yard is impeccably stylish.
Yes, manicured.
Gardeners.
So Anna Kendrick is a mom. She is a single mom with a little boy in first grade in kind of idyllic suburban Connecticut. Warfield, Connecticut. And
basically Christy Lemire's life.
No, I mean, well, we're going to get to that.
Not saying.
No, we're going to get to this, though.
Sorry,
because
Chris.
So Anna Kendrick is a mom.
Fantasy.
Blake Lively is a mom. I'm just plowing through here.
Yes.
And they form this really unlikely friendship. Anna Kendrick is like, perky and she's organized and she's really involved at school and she has this mommy vlog where she does like cooking and crafts and, you know, how to tips.
She's full Martha Stewart.
She is. It's really cute. And then Blake Lively would seem to be her absolute opposite. She's like, who gives a fuck? And she's just enormously stylish. She's got this edge to her. She's brash.
She works in the city.
Catherine Hahn was unavailable.
Yes, and she wants to...
No. Blake Lively owns this.
Okay. Yes, no, she wants to drink in the middle of the day. And so they become...
Wait, that's wrong.
Right, well, it's how they bond, right?
Okay.
So... they would seem to be unlikely friends, but their kids are friends, and they start to hang out with each other, and they connect unexpectedly. And I love the fact that off the top, these two women are drawn really beautifully and with great detail, and they're really fleshed out. And I really related to each of them in different ways, because I've been perky joiner mom who signs up for everything, and I've been, you know, drunk mom in the middle of the day. I know I have. I'm like the Venn diagram between the two of them.
I'm learning so much.
No, it's true. Moms get drunk in the middle of the day. Moms go home.
How do you think they stay perky?
Moms go home after school, and they have play dates just to hang out with each other and open a bottle of Prosecco.
Oh, and then it's pizza night.
No, seriously. I have a lot of girlfriends that I've gotten to know very, very well because our kids happen to be friends, and we start drinking at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
And the thing that happens, and Christy will know this, is that you end up friends with parents, with your kids' friends' parents, that you otherwise wouldn't hang out with at all.
Right?
Like, you may have nothing in common with. Or there's some other parent at the school that you really click with, and your kids either start out as friends and grow apart, or your kids have nothing to do with each other and want nothing to do with each other, and you're like, ugh.
I've been in both of those situations, yeah.
I have too.
So it's weird. So even though this movie is really over the top.
Don't have kids, y'all.
And really, really winking and really knowing and really like slick and glitzy and stylish, there is a nugget of truth to its fundamental basis of its characters and its story that I think makes it work ultimately. So Blake Lively's character one day just disappears.
Yes.
She asks Anna Kendrick's character to pick up her son from school, which is a routine they've gotten into. It's been pretty convenient. And she just doesn't come back. And Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively's husband, played by the hunky Henry Golding, star of Crazy Rich Asians, they form a relationship, and it gets kind of twisty from there.
I love this movie.
Me too.
I had a blast. And I think I've been seeing some reviews that are kind of crabby. And I think that they were expecting it to be Gone Girl or like The Girl on the Train or that kind of thriller. And I don't think that's the movie that Paul Feig set out to make. I think that this is to Gone Girl what like The Heat is to a standard cop movie, which is that he's using the tropes and the trappings, and he is taking the plot seriously to an extent, and that he is following through on it, but ultimately he's there to create characters and tell jokes, and I'm fine with that.
And also lavish in the trappings of leafy suburban Connecticut and the clothes and the shoes.
This movie is designed the way Paul Feig dresses.
Yeah.
Like, have you ever seen Paul Feig? He's not just like always wearing a suit, but he's always like really dapper.
Perfect pocket square at all times. The hair, the glasses.
Yeah, he's natty. Yeah. You know, and so this movie is natty.
It is. And Blake Lively, of course, being 5'10 and statuesque, can wear these clothes.
Yeah.
We saw that with what's that movie where she keeps not
Age
getting older?
Adeline.
Yeah, she wears those clothes. But Anna Kendrick, who is like my size, she's like 5'1" and itty bitty. She also gets to wear like the perfect little Martha Stewart twin sets and all that.
Like, this is a movie with a color story.
It actually, a scene in a walk-in closet is like a pivotal plot point in
here. Yeah.
So
I have a theory though that I want to bounce off.
Please.
Of. Just based on just a handful of reviews that I've seen out there that are not digging this movie. I think this is a movie that women and gay men are going to like more than straight men do.
I don't know. We need Matt to go. We've got a woman.
I'll go see it. Much
we need you to be our tiebreaker here on that.
You must speak for all straight men everywhere.
I do.
It's just a theory. I don't know. This is a fact. This is based on a very limited pool of responses. But just, I think, based on what this movie is doing and what it looks like and what people think it is supposed to be, that's the vibe I'm getting.
Interesting. So it is a bit of a high wire act in that, it's jokey, but it's also increasingly suspenseful, and there is a mystery at its core that you're along for the ride to help solve. Right. Anna Kendrick's character becomes kind of a makeshift Nancy Drew and uses her organizational abilities.
Yes.
We've established that she's a woman who, like, has her shit together. She's focused. She's task-oriented. So seeking out a missing woman is, like, a perfect job for her.
Exactly. Even her knowledge of, like, how to do a web series comes into play. So, like, you know, it's just she's very smart about how this stuff. And, yeah, everything that happens scans with what we know about this character and what her specific set of skills happens to be. There's also wall-to-wall great vintage French pop songs.
Yes, very fun.
Which really add a certain je ne sais quoi to the proceedings.
A very kicky vibe. And it also acknowledges that fact in that, you know, we see Anna Kendrick kind of getting lost in, like, dancing to some sexy little number while
Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, while Blake Lively's making her a martini. And so we feel that too.
Oh yeah, right. That early on. Yeah. Totally. I had a really great time. This was a fun movie to look at. It was a fun kind of twisty mystery to unravel. And I liked their dynamic together. Because those characters are oil and water, but they somehow, like, find this common ground or not. And and again, just I think this is, you know, when Dave and I did our Linoleum Knife special episode about Two for the Road, and we talked about there's the actual symbolism of Audrey Hepburn's clothes, like the auteur theory of Audrey Hepburn's wardrobe. Like, the clothes do really tell a story here.
Well, the Stepford Wife dress at the end, I would say, is my favorite because it sums everything up.
Complete with crinolines.
Yes. But you know, like, Anna Kendrick can do, like, fast talking and self deprecating, and this role is very much in her wheelhouse.
Totally.
She does not believe in herself the way she should. And then Blake Lively, we forget, she's stunningly gorgeous, but she can act. You know,
totally.
She's great in The Town.
Yes.
And so this allows her to play a deeper, edgier, grittier role than that she gets credit for being able to do all the time.
No, I think she's underrated. And although there is one thing that a friend of mine who works in the business pointed out in the trailer, and now I can't unsee it, which is when the two of them meet and it's pouring rain, you can tell that the sun is totally shining. they had a rain machine.
Sometimes it rains in the sunshine.
Yeah, I guess, but it's like, it's a little much. Sometimes it snows in April.
Yes. Also, Henry Golding, you know, is hunky.
Shirt does come off, folks. Just letting you know.
So anyway, this is a really fun movie. I laughed the whole way through. It's stylish and just, like, impeccably planned in every way. So I'm saying 7.9.
I said 8.
Actually, I'll say 8 also. Why not? Just for the ease of math. It's a 77%. And again, I think as you point out, that might just be a matter of expectations being wrong.
Could be.
So what else is opening wide? White Boy Rick. Take it away, Alonzo.
Oh, yes. Okay, so this just premiered at the Toronto Film Festival. Based on a true story. Which is 5 words that always kind of give me pause when I see it in a film. But yeah, this is indeed a thing that really happened. It takes place from about 1984 to 1987. It's about this kid named Richard Wershe Jr., whose dad was kind of a small-time gun dealer in Detroit. And Rick Jr. starts selling guns to some of the drug gangs in town. The FBI latches onto him and they start using him as an informant, but they also start having him sell drugs for them as a way to, like, track people down. And before you know it, this kid, you know, while still a teenager, becomes kind of a kingpin. And it seems to be going well until the FBI kind of stabs him in the back.
So the story of how they found this actor, Richie Merritt, is actually a little more interesting than the movie that he ended up starring in.
I bet.
They found him in the principal's office at his high school in Baltimore.
Huh.
He was 15. He'd never acted. And a casting director had come through looking for young men to read for this role. And Richie Merritt was in trouble again. And he was sitting in the principal's office. And the principal, this is according to Matthew McConaughey, doing an interview.
So it must be true.
He would not embellish, right? I believe he's telling us the truth, that apparently the principal's like, well, start with this kid, you know, and that's how he got this role. He had never acted before, and he does bring a certain kind of grimy authenticity to the role, but, you know, you don't always strike gold with the, you know, first time, never before actor. It's such a rare thing.
Yeah, not everybody is Sean Baker.
No, and here you see that he seems really stiff and really outmatched when he's acting opposite somebody who is such a veteran and who is such a presence, like Matthew McConaughey,
right?
You know, or Jennifer Jason Leigh,
or Bruce Dern,
right? Bruce Dern and Piper Laurie as this kid's grandparents are barely in it. Like, yeah. I don't think I even realized until afterward, like, oh, that's Piper Laurie, because she basically just sits in the passenger seat of the car.
Yeah,
and
like,
that's
it. Well, yeah. I knew they were, just because I clocked them in the trailer. I was like, ooh, Bruce Dern and Piper Laurie are in this. And then I was like, ooh, Bruce Dern and Piper Laurie are barely in this.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's got definitely a gritty kind of lived-in quality to this era of Detroit.
Yeah.
Right? And there's a vivid sense of place, and they have a really good time. Jan Demange directed this. They have a really good time.
In 71.
Yes, with the clothes, the early 80s clothes, the scenes at the roller rink are, yes, very evocative of a certain kind of vibe, musically and style-wise.
Yeah, they're definitely, you know, reveling in the sort of period trappings. They go see Footloose at the drive-in at one point, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's one of those movies where no one ever looks warm.
Right, it's like it has snowed. It has snowed, and the snow is still on the ground. Yeah. But it's like February, March, black snow. I just found this to be, you know, evocative and atmospheric. But we've seen this kind of story before. And then the thing that makes this particular story interesting, what befalls him, we don't really learn until the very end. And by then it's like, oh, this is why we're supposed to care about this person.
Exactly.
And then there are, you know, title cards at the end.
Yes, of what happened to everybody. And blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
And I feel like it buries the lead.
And it feels like it was a cable miniseries that got trimmed down to theatrical length. Because there's stuff that just feels missing. Like, there's a scene where he's like, Dad, I want to go back to school. And then he gets shot. And then after he recovers from getting shot, McConaughey's like, well, they say you can't go back to school because it's too dangerous. I was like, oh. So he did go back to school? Like, I didn't even know. Like, they throw these things out there and then kind of pick them up later on. And you know, all the stuff with the FBI just feels like kind of an afterthought in a way, just because it feels like you're sort of missing the steps in between of, like, you know, this thing turns to this thing turns to this thing. Like, that's a story that the movie is kind of clumsily telling.
Especially in the third act, it kind of is like, all of a sudden, hey, here we are.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So
I did like Belle Powley as his sister. She was the girl from Diary of a Teenage Girl.
She's always interesting.
Yeah, so she's quite good in this. And McConaughey is, you know, McConaughey-ing for the most part. It's neither good nor bad. It's fine.
It's like it's swaggering, hustling, fast-talking McConaughey. It's very much in his wheelhouse.
Yeah, it's flop sweat McConaughey.
So I'm seeing 5.2, and that's mostly just because the cast is so great and it is kind of moody.
Yeah, I said 5. I mean, it definitely nails the atmosphere, and there's some fun kind of period touches, but it's unsatisfying narratively.
Yes. So our number is a 5.1. It's a 52% on the tomato meter.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, you want to do Lizzie? Let's talk about Lizzie. Yes.
Yeah. I saw this at the Sundance Film Festival this year, and it was one of my favorite films. I really loved it, and I could tell even then. Like, I think I'm still the top score on Metacritic, so I guess I maybe liked it more than other people did.
Congrats.
Little known fact about Alonzo Duraldi, as much as he likes Christmas, he even more is a fan of axes.
It's true.
And axe murders.
Yeah, give me a good hatchet, and I'm good. So, yeah, so this is a true crime story. It's about Lizzie Borden. It stars Chloe Sevigny. And it is the kind of film that is basically like, okay, you think you know this story, but you know the popular version of it, and maybe this person that you think of as a monster deserves more compassion than you think. So we kind of get to know Lizzie's just suffocating home life with her parents, and some respite appears when they hire a new Irish maid who is played by Kristen Stewart, and she and Lizzie become very close. And you come to see that circumstances sort of force Lizzie into a corner because of, you know, the patriarchy, basically, like women in the 19th century and what they're allowed to inherit and, you know, who makes family decisions and all these kind of things. And you sort of see these sort of moments of kind of quiet vengeance along the way where, like, you know, her father is raping the maid, and the only thing that Lizzie can do about it is to put broken glass outside the door so that when he sneaks out of the room barefoot, he's going to cut the crap out of his feet. And ultimately, yes, the she does dispatch her parents, not with the number of whacks that you heard. But yeah, this is, I think, just a kind of a, it's a like, let's take a step back and let's look at this story in a different context. And now what do you think about Lizzie Borden?
I was really impressed by the chemistry between Chloe Sevigny and Kristen Stewart.
Oh, yeah.
I understand that this is a movie that Chloe Sevigny has wanted to get made for quite a while.
Oh, okay.
She is a producer on it. Mm-hmm. And they both always make such interesting choices individually.
Yes.
So to see them together and see that blossoming chemistry, it's tentative and it's subtle and it's tense. And to see when there finally is, you know, a full-blown romantic connection between them, it makes sense. It's a thrilling moment in a movie that doesn't have a lot of thrilling moments. The reason my number is what it is because I found this to be just like one note in terms of its pacing and its tone until the actual murders happen. Hmm. And then all of a sudden it just gets cranked up to 11.
I guess for me, the fact that we know what this story is and we know that the murders are coming kind of, for me anyway, imbued it with a certain level of suspense. Like the whole time I was sort of like, okay, when's it going to happen? What's going to be the motivating factor? Like, you know, it's sort of like when a movie starts with the thing that happens and then it's all flashback. Mm-hmm. You know, this one, the flashback's sort of built in because we know where it's going.
It starts with the thing that happened, though.
Oh, does it? Okay. I saw it in January, so I don't remember.
Yeah, we do. We see the bodies on the floor and we hear a scream and we hear Lizzie yell, you know, go fetch an ambulance or call the police. And then it goes back. Literally, it says 6 months earlier.
Okay, gotcha.
So we do have that device.
I literally do that then.
We do. So in case you didn't know, Lizzie Borden allegedly killed people. No, and I do appreciate the attempt to, you know, visit what we think is a famous story through fresh eyes.
Sure.
I do. And, you know, the details of, you know, turn of the century New England and the creaky floors, and you can hear every single step people are taking in this house that's full of secrets and full of misdeeds, you know, it does create a subtle underlying tension. It's a great supporting cast. You mentioned the dad. Jamie Sheridan plays the dad.
Yes.
Fiona Shaw is Lizzie Borden's stepmom. Kim Dickens does not get a lot to do.
She does not.
As Lizzie Borden's sister, Emma.
Yeah.
That is another complaint I have here, is that you have this embarrassment of riches in your supporting cast. And she's just sort of like the good girl who doesn't say all the right things.
Right. And I think sometimes, like you said, if this is a passion project for Chloe Sevigny, then you like call in some favors and you get people involved when even like, here's this role. It's not much, but it'd be awesome if you could come in and do it, you know? So yeah, I would have liked to, you know, I'm a big fan of Kim.
Yes.
I would have loved to see more of her,
of
but
course.
Yeah, that is something that we could have done better.
And Dennis O'Hare is what she,
oh,
he is,
God,
he's the
he's
uncle.
So good in this.
He is really good in this, and he is just like skeevy and untrustworthy from the very first second that you see him, you know, but then you further learn the depth of his depravity as the film goes on. Yeah, I mean, it's well made and it's well acted and it's an interesting perspective on this famous story, but it just kind of didn't grab me.
Okay, fair enough.
Thank you. So what is your number?
I gave it a 9. I'm okay. A big fan.
I'm saying 6.7, so our number is a 7.9. 75% on the tomato meter.
If you are a fan of either of these actresses, you should absolutely check it out.
Okay. Finally, we're going to talk about what may be the best movie of the week.
For some people.
There's a big variation in your score on this one.
Yeah,
so this is going to be fun. So, Mandy. Right. You want full-blown batshit Nick Cage. Here it is. Mandy. You're rolling your eyes at me already.
I'm waiting for you to describe the plot, because I really want to see how that's going to go.
Okay, so Nicolas Cage and Andrea Riseborough live in the woods in Oregon, kind of middle of nowhere, rural Oregon, foresty Oregon.
1983.
Their life is really blissful and quiet and serene. He works in logging. She is an artist. And they live in this really funky kind of log cabin in the middle of nowhere. And they hang out watching TV and drinking beer and smoking cigarettes. And their life is really quiet and pleasant. Until one day, this LSD-fueled cult swoops in and abducts her and drags her back to their... Well, here's a question. Are they still at their house the whole time, or do they bring her back to their lair?
Oh, I remember this trailer.
They bring her... Yes. Yeah, they bring her back to, like, a motel.
Right. Is it a motel?
I thought it was a motel.
Anyway, they take her somewhere. They have a headquarters, though. The place with the burning cross in the middle
that
of it?
That comes later.
Okay. Anyway, so I got to look up while we're talking here. Who is the guy?
Linus Roach.
Thank you very much. Okay, you knew. Okay, so let's say the cult leader, Linus Roach, sees her on the road while riding in his van full of sycophants and hangers-on and decides he must have her. She must be a part of the cult. She must be the crown jewel in his cult. So he has his people go and abduct her, and they are a biker gang that has been turned into, like, guar through using too much bad LSD, if I am not mistaken. Really talking about the plot is pointless, because this movie is not about the plot. This movie is about how, like, psychedelic and trippy and artful.
So it's like
and
Mad like Max cosplay.
Lurid. If you like Suspiria, if you like Dario Argento's Suspiria, you will like this movie because it similarly creates a mood just through really bold, lurid, vibrant color.
I'm only saying no because I like Dario Argento's Suspiria. I did not like this movie.
But didn't this remind you of it from an aesthetic perspective?
Okay. Did you see Beyond the Black Rainbow?
I did not.
Okay.
Same director. Panos Cosmatos.
Yes, whose father directed, like, Rambo 3 or something? George Pan Cosmatos? Anyway. I forget. Anyway, he was like a hacky filmmaker of yore. And Panos is very interested in sort of kind of 70s and 80s grindhouse tropes, I guess. And so Beyond the Black Rainbow was like, I mean, you think this movie had a convoluted plot. Like, don't even try to follow what Beyond the Black Rainbow is about. You just sort of go with it, the mood and the tone and all that stuff. And I dug it. I thought it was an interesting, you know, homage. And it was 100% what it wanted to be all the time. And then I get to this movie, and there's a couple things. It's sort of like, A, oh, so this is all you got then.
Really quick. George P. Cosmatos directed Cobra, Rambo, First Blood Part 2, and is credited as director of Tombstone.
Oh.
That's a whole different story.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, anyway, that guy's son. So, anyway, so on the one hand, I'm thinking, like, all right, so this is just what you do then, is sort of try and recreate these sort of weird old, you know, horror science fiction movies. But then, second of all, I just got completely lost in it. This one's trying to have a plot as opposed to the previous film, and it makes zero sense. And it's sort of
what,
like,
does it make sense about it?
Okay, if the movie can't decide if the cult leader is a joke or if he actually has the power to summon these guar bikers with a flute in the middle of the forest.
Both. I would argue both.
And then he has this, like, enormous wooden chapel in the mountains somewhere. It's like, wait, then either this guy is a total idiot who's got these losers around them, or he has some genuine power or something to have all this happening. Like, it wants it both ways, and that doesn't work. I got very bored with it because I felt like this movie sort of unleashes its bag of tricks in the first 25 minutes and then it just kind of gives you variations on a theme, and I got tired of it.
No, the bag of tricks keeps getting bigger and the bag keeps changing because you don't get full-blown nutty Nicolas Cage until, like, a good solid hour and a half in.
Yeah, but
you don't get wild-eyed, like, coke snorting, you know, crying on the toilet Nicolas Cage until far into
it. Right, but here's the thing. I think there's a place and a gradation for unhinged Nicolas Cage. But if you're going to put him in a scene with Bill Duke, who is genuinely acting and who is being very quiet and centered and focused and intense, and then opposite him have Nicolas Cage being like, it doesn't work. And I think there's a lot of things in this movie that just don't work. And I was not amused. I was not impressed. I was not interested.
I dug it. It's just bizarre. It's a little too long, but it is slow, but there's like a mesmerizing quality to the languid pacing here. And you do feel like you have been immersed in this world, and you are also doing these same drugs as all these people, whether you want to be or not.
Andrea Riseborough definitely nails a certain kind of like pre-goth girl. Like, you've seen this girl at Comic-Con, where she's got like kind of the flat hair and the big eyes and the heavy metal t-shirt and the very pale skin. Like, you know, that was very evocative of a certain, you know, people that I have seen and known in my life. But it's at the service of this just like violent cartoon that I just got tired of.
But the violent cartoon is creative over and over again. Like, there's a whole chainsaw fight that is kind of gnarly. That I dug. Yeah. Like, the way that people die is kind of interesting.
Maybe if you didn't see Beyond the Black Rainbow and this guy's, you know, methodology is new to you, then maybe it plays better. But for me, it just sort of felt like a rehash and not as good.
Hmm. Well, I had a good time. But it is all of 2 hours and 1 minute long.
Oh, yes, it is.
And the score is really trippy, too.
It is.
The score is like synthy, but it's also got like intense guitar at certain times.
But I feel like that's been a thing lately where when people are doing something 80s-ish, right, they really kind of crank that up. So, I mean, yeah, it's done well, but it's not unprecedented.
All right, well, I had a blast. I'm saying 9. If you like this kind of movie, you will like this movie.
I said 3. I was really contemplating leaving on more than one occasion.
No. Yes. Is there a certain moment you can go back to and say, this is when I want to get up and leave?
No, I just was bored, you know. I was just like, okay, I see what this movie's doing. I know what it wants to be and what it's going to keep being for the next however the hell long we're stuck in here. Yeah. So I'm good, but no, I stayed to the end.
Did Dave see it?
He has not.
Because I can imagine Dave digging this.
He might. But I think, okay, I can't remember if he saw the first film or not.
Okay. So our number is 6. It's at 98% on the tomato meter.
It'd be higher except for Alonzo.
No, I did not review it. And I have a sense that I'm an outlier on this one. So, you know, knock yourself out.
Yes. So I'll mention a couple other things really fast that neither of you guys have seen, but they are curiosities for various reasons. They are both documentaries. One is called Rodents of Unusual Size. It is a documentary about nutria rats in Louisiana.
Okay.
And do you know what those are?
Yeah, they're giant.
These are big-ass rats.
They're like long hair, right?
They are giant. Well, they're these giant rats that were brought up to the U.S. from South America to breed with muskrats to make a specific kind of exotic fur in like the 1930s. And what happened was...
And then they got out.
Right, and then they got out. And so they are... Matt showing Alonzo a picture of what a nutria looks like.
So they're like the kudzu of the animal kingdom.
They're enormous, and they have long tails, and they have orange teeth.
Right. Now, it's like a beaver, but without the flat tail kind
right.
of, like, and bigger.
And they are causing the Louisiana coastline, which already is very fragile, to erode even faster because they gnaw away all the vegetation. They're vegetarian animals. Mm. And so they eat all that grass. So, like, you know, the part of Louisiana where they shot the Beasts of the Southern Wild, which already was kind of precarious.
Like, these are the beasts.
These are some of them, yeah. And it's about the role that nutria have played over the years in culture and the fight to eradicate them. There are a lot of folks who were like, you know, third generation, like old school Cajuns who have lived in this part of Louisiana their entire lives, who get on their little boats and they go hunt nutria. And there are people who, you know, pay them $5 a tail. Hmm. You know, you can get like 1,000 nutria in a day or whatever, and that's your living. There's some people who use the fur to make fashion statements. There's one fashion designer who will add nutria fur to a hat or to a collar of a little, in like a cute little vintage jacket, or to a dress. People cook it.
Mm.
Yes, Kermit Ruffins is in it, and he has a little jazz club.
Eat rabbit.
Yeah,
no, that's true.
Supposedly it tastes like rabbit, and it's apparently a very clean meat because
they're vegetarians.
They're vegetarians, right? And they're not being raised, you know, in captivity and pumped full of antibiotics. Like, they're wild, natural, free.
Farm-to-table nutrition.
Yeah, but people just get freaked out because they're like these disgusting-looking rats. And so Kermit Ruffins is in it, and the trumpeter, and he, you know, has a club in Treme where he plays music and he serves Nutria. He did a whole Nutria barbecue, and so there are chefs who are trying to, you know, make Nutria a palatable meal. And so it's interesting. It's about how it's entwined.
Is it nutritious?
It might be. It's a lean thing. But yeah,
the
they
other white people.
And then the flip side of like these really poor people who are struggling to survive, you know, by hunting the Nutria, you have these rich people living on the golf course in Kenner, which is just west of New Orleans.
Oh.
And the Nutria are all over the place there. But they like them. They think they're cute. And some of them want them as pets. I mean, they put traps out to trap the Nutria in the water parts of the golf course. And the local residents, like, take the traps away. They want the Nutria to live. So it's sort of a fascinating look. It's only 70 minutes long. Hmm. Wendell Pierce narrates it. New Orleans native Wendell Pierce narrates it. And there's also a documentary out this week called American Chaos.
Yes, which I've not seen.
But you know what it is?
It's another, like, oh, God, how did we get Trump documentary? Right?
Yes, yes. So Jim Stern, who has done several documentaries, he did one on Yao Ming. He did one on Michael Jordan. He kind of turns the camera on himself. His brother was in the Obama administration and helped write the Paris Climate Accords.
Hmm.
And, you know, very involved in what, you know, was a key Obama, you know, initiative that has since been overturned in the world of Trump. And so Jim Stern is sort of a documentary version of the story we get in the New York Times every few months. Like, let's go to Trump country and find out who these people are. What do they think? And it begins like 6 months before the election, and he goes to Florida, and he goes to West Virginia, and he goes to, I think he goes to Texas. Can't remember, but various places.
But he doesn't go to Michigan or Wisconsin.
Right. Does he interview any Nutria?
He does not go to Louisiana or eat any Nutria. That's the ultimate cross-section here. But, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's, we've seen several movies now where we have to relive election night. Mm. That Obama documentary, The Final Year, you know, we have people sitting around watching election returns and being sad.
Right.
You have that here again as well.
And there was another doc, too, that was all set.
About the fashion dude, World According to Andre.
No, but there was another one that was literally just like it was all on that day where they had crews in all these different cities doing different stories about it. And we have Fahrenheit 11/9 coming up.
Now, have either of you guys seen that yet? Did you see it? Okay,
no.
It's screening next week, so that comes out next week. So we'll have to talk about that here.
I will try and catch it.
Yes. So it's, you know, it's not necessarily all that eye opening. I mean, I think he aims to explain the phenomenon. It feels a little late, you know, but it is out there, too. So if you are a masochist and want to relive the horrors, American Chaos is out there for you. So let me recap what we talked about this week. We did A Simple Favor, which Alonzo and I both liked very much. We gave it an 8. We did The Predator, which neither of us liked very well. We gave it a 3.9. White Boy Rick, we were both also kind of meh on. Gave it a 5.1. Lizzie, Alonzo liked a lot more than I did. We gave that a 7.9. And finally, the best movie of the week.
Liar!
Mandy.
Which Christy liked a lot more than I did.
Yes, I gave it a 9. Alonzo gives it a 3. That makes it a 6. Even I can do that math. So thank you guys so much for sticking around and for listening to us and being so sweet. We read all your tweets and all your comments on my website, and we are overwhelmed.
Yes, we appreciate the outpouring. It's been lovely to read, and you know, obviously we love working together. We want to keep this thing going, and we're glad that you guys are interested in us doing that as well. And Ben will be back.
Ben's in Atlanta.
Yeah. And so, I'll have news in a couple of days.
Okay,
right.
Cool.
Yeah.
And we have a fourth spot on my little board here to plug in a fourth mic. So, Ben, I know you must travel with a mic wherever you go.
I'll bring a second one if I have to.
So eventually you will see all four of us here, and then we can do heads up on the podcast. and no one will know what we're doing. Anyway, thank you for sticking around with us. We miss you. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.